from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Dave Iverson, and that's the SF Jazz Collective, one of many groups who will help usher in next week's grand opening of the SF Jazz Center in downtown San Francisco. Wednesday night's grand opening concert also features McCoy Tyner and Esperanza Spalding, with legendary jazz aficionado Bill Cosby serving as MC. But the new center is more than just about stars. It's also the nation's first standalone building dedicated exclusively to jazz. Its purpose is to bring jazz to the community and to bring the community to jazz. In the hour ahead, we'll hear about that interchange, and we'll also hear from some local jazz musicians performing in our studio. It's all ahead on Forum after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Dave Iverson. When Randall Klein arrived in San Francisco in the mid-1970s, he was just one more aspiring musician, hoping to make $100 a gig. In the early 1980s, he secured a $10,000 grant to launch Jazz in the City, the beginning of what would become the SF Jazz Festival. And next week, 30 years after that first gathering, Klein will oversee the grand opening of the SF Jazz Center in downtown San Francisco. It's the first building designed exclusively for jazz in the country, though exclusive is the last thing the center wants to be. It's designed instead to be an open community space, as free-flowing as the jazz music itself, a place where you can literally see a concert from the sidewalk. The grand opening concert at the SF Jazz Center is next Wednesday night, and in this hour of Forum, we take up what the new center means for the city and for jazz, and it's a conversation that will feature a little bit of accompaniment. That's jazz musicians John Santos and Adam Thies. They will be joining us throughout this hour. They're both involved in the opening of the SF Jazz Center. John is the resident artistic director at the center. He'll perform all week long at the grand opening. John, thanks very much for being with us this morning.
Thank you so much, Steve. It's a pleasure to be here.
Adam Thies is the trombonist you just heard. He's the founding of the San Francisco music collective called the Jazz Mafia. He'll be the band leader for SF Jazz Community Band, and his Realistic Orchestra will be performing at the SF Jazz Center on January the 31st. Adam, welcome.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Here, too, is Randall Klein, the founder and executive artistic director at SF Jazz. Randall, good morning.
Good morning, Dave.
And the designer, architect of the building, Mark Cavagnero, is here, too. He also designed the recent renovation of the Oakland Museum and the ODC Dance Center in the Mission District of San Francisco, and is the architect for the new SF Jazz Center. Mark, good morning.
Good morning. Thank you.
So, Randall Klein, tell us about what this building represents, why this grand opening next week in San Francisco is literally an opening of a unique space.
Well, it's a new cultural institution for San Francisco that grew organically from a small idea here in 1983 about putting on a community jazz festival that featured only Bay Area artists. And when we started in 1983, the whole intent of what we did was to present a Freudian slip, to present a broad view of what jazz is and what jazz is here in the Bay Area. John, sitting right next to me here, performed on that very first festival in 83, and with an Afro-Cuban band, Orquesta Batachanga. And on that same bill, we had, I believe there was a stride piano player and an avant-garde group and a bebop group on the same night. And, from that moment onward, the programming philosophy and how we view jazz, just kept expanding.
What is it going to feel like to you when that building opens?
Well, it's pretty spectacular. I mean, right now, seeing it all come to life, something that's been, sort of fantasy in head and then two-dimensional for many years become three-dimensional. Mark Cavagnero, the architect, encounters this in his work all the time, and he talked a lot about this. You know, and from his perspective, and he can talk more about this. You know, you draw something, you see something, you don't really know what it is till it's there. You know, there's a phrase I've been using a lot this week and walking around and just seeing how beautifully Mark has designed it and how great music sounds in there. And you know, it's a simple thing; just it works. And something that's really the feeling is, you know, wow, it really works.
How was music influential in the actual design of the building? I don't mean just in terms of acoustics, but I know you're a John Coltrane fan, for example. So is there a musicality to the actual architecture of the building itself, not just acoustically, but in form?
There's a direct intention, I think, to play with the ideas of structure versus exploration, and the idea that there are certain rhythms within the glass facade that face the public streets. And I think there's also an idea involved that things are not at all ever in the middle. They're sort of at one end or the other of a spectrum. So it's a very closed, focused great hall. It's a very open, transparent public space. And the interplay, the counterpoint, I think is very much what makes the building interesting.
And John Santos, as a performer, how does this strike you? And what's welcoming to you about having this place, not only as a place that kind of makes a statement about the importance of jazz, but also makes a statement about it being open and that the music comes in and comes out?
Yeah, it's important. We had the honor of playing in there the other day. Was it yesterday or day before? Day before yesterday. And we just played in there as an experiment, really, for the press and for folks who are concerned about those questions. And for us, it was wonderful to be sitting there and have the first seat be, you could reach over and shake hands with a person sitting in the front seat. The stage is only 2 feet high off the ground. So we're like part of the audience, and it's very much – we're using the terminology of it being like a sacred space, like a church. It's like a church. You know, when you're sitting there, the audience is not removed from you. And it's the same all the way to the back of the hall. You look up. It kind of goes up as opposed to away from you. And so it, the proximity of all the faces, you could recognize every single person in that room.
I read, I think, that no one is further than like 55 feet from the performer. Does that matter in particular in jazz to have that sort of direct connection?
Particularly, I think, in jazz, it matters because, you know, we're used to playing in our place is an intimate place. It's playing clubs, and we're used to having that proximity, and we feed off of that. So being able to be close is really important for us. We're not like 60,000 seat-filled stadium. We're about playing for an audience of people who are appreciators of the art form, and we love to see their faces and see their expressions.
How does that play for you as a performer, Adam? If you're able to see me sitting 10 feet away from you, is there a responsiveness to that that matters as a jazz musician?
Yeah. I mean, it in so many ways for the musicians and for the audience. I know that there's a certain edge that seems to happen for groups that I play in, and I noticed it if I've seen a group maybe play on a very large space and then seen the same group playing in like maybe some unannounced after party, you know. In a small place, there's just this edge. It's like you can't fake it. Anything that happens is like it's out there, it's in the air, and people are going to hear every little thing. And a lot of it does have to do not just with the sound and what they're hearing, but what they're sensing. A lot of it is communicated through body language and gestures. And when you're close enough to notice it, the performers definitely have to take on a little different role than when they can just kick back and it's all, you know.
It's not anonymous. I mean, it's very personal in that way, it sounds like. As you were designing the building, Mark Cavaniero, did you think of that term, the after party? I mean, did you want to have that sort of sense to it?
Sure. It was very much about the energy and the life and the interaction between the performer and the audience and bringing the people around all sides and having the artists feel as though they're emerged in this group of people. And just as John was saying, this idea of a church or a sacred space or a temple, something Randall and I talked about a lot with a great deal of fun and enthusiasm, looking at non-traditional spaces, not looking at theaters actually, but looking at community spaces.
Well, in fact, as I understand it, you did some traveling to sort of get in a sense of what kind of space you would like. And one of the inspirations, which seems very unlikely to me on just reading it, but I'd love to hear more about it, was the old South Meeting Hall in Boston. Is that right? And how did that inform a jazz hall?
Well, I will actually turn this over to Mark because this ties into our New England roots. But the dialogue with Mark was a long one. It was, you know, close to 10 years about, you know, trying to understand just what Adam is talking about, actually, this idea that it was really about energy. You know, we were trying to create something that was quite difficult, actually, which was, a concert hall that had the intimacy and immediacy of a club, that type. And it took us in lots of different directions, you know, exploring that. And Mark and I would send these emails back and forth, and we had coffee quite a bit about these things. It was really a fun process. But Mark can really talk about the meeting halls. And
okay. Anyway, we were looking for, the more I listened to Randall, what Randall wanted, in the beginning it seems his goals were mutually exclusive, right? They were, again, polar opposites, the intimacy of a small club and the grand focus and intensity and musical quality of a concert hall. And the more we talked, the more I realized they didn't have to be exclusive. We just had to rethink the type. So I started actually looking at meeting halls and churches, and I started looking at Quaker churches, which are all about consensus building and no axial or
there's a lot of power silence. Relationship. There's a lot of silence, though, in Quaker meetings.
There's a lot of silence in jazz. And the idea of people relating to each other as equals and not necessarily us and them and having an audience, a performer, a proscenium arch, and a curtain surrounding which and defining how you see the artist. But this was a sense of seeing people around the artist and with the artist. And it was challenging in terms of making the acoustics work and the sight lines work and the technology work. And that's when we brought in really top-notch consultants. But once we embraced the idea of doing something unconventional that we would make for ourselves, the rest started to fall into place.
John, say something more about that, about there's a lot of silence in jazz.
Well, yeah, music, the silence is as important and arguably more important than the music itself. The pauses, the rhythm, the stops, the relation with breathing. That aspect of being part of the audience has a lot of special meaning for me and for those of us who have an African traditional kind of folklore root, mine being Caribbean. In Afro-Caribbean music, following the African root, the traditional music, which is where jazz has evolved from, is always played in a circle. And you are surrounded by people, and people, you are part of a circle, and the drums are in the circle, and people come into the circle to dance and to sing, and it's acoustic. And you get, with that proximity, you also hear the instruments, and you hear the natural sound of the instruments. You're not just listening to whatever quality sound system you have, and there's a great sound system there, but you get to hear and feel the quality of the timbres of the instruments, and you feel that as well when you're close.
John Santos. He is a resident artistic director at SF Jazz Center. Will be participating all week in the grand opening festivities at the new SF Jazz Center. Why don't we listen for a moment to one of the many groups that you will be hosting at the new center. Let's listen first. This is to Dave Holland. He'll be performing at the SF Jazz Center on February 7th through 10th. He was a bassist with Miles Davis. So you want to tell us anything more about Dave Holland before we listen to this, Randall Klein?
Well, you know, genius is an oft-tossed-out word, but he's really just a genius and a true virtuoso on his instrument. And the reason I call him a genius is because he's virtuosic as an instrumentalist and been very influential, you know, from his Miles Davis to solo albums. And as a band leader, he's some of the most exciting groups in the history of jazz have been groups that he's led. And he's a wonderful composer. And, you know, that's a real, you know, unbeatable trio of things to have. And what's great in this week, and you know, it's not necessarily about Dave, but we're showing all those sides of Dave in four nights. And in fact, that's the focus of most of our programming. There are these Thursday through Sunday nights that the resident artistic directors like John focus on. And sometimes it's something very different each night. Sometimes it's something very related. And Dave's night, it's a solo bass night, and it's a duo with the extraordinary pianist Kenny Barron. And then it's the group he's best known for now, his quintet. And he's premiering a new electric band with Kevin Eubank. So, that's the big buildup on Dave.
let's listen. Yeah, so, let's listen to a little. Thank you.
Kevin's playing on the Sunday.
And a little bit of Dave Holland, who will be performing at SF Jazz Center February 7th through 10th, the grand opening of the SF Jazz Center next week in downtown San Francisco. Adam Thies, let me ask you about something that you're going to be doing, which I'm curious about, which is you're going to be the band leader for the new SF Jazz Community Band. How is that? What is that? How is that going to work?
Well, it's a really fun idea. Randall and I had lunch a while ago and kind of were brainstorming about it. And it's a way to get people involved in something that's a regular playing experience that maybe could push them in some different directions. But it's rooted in a tradition of like different levels of players getting together and professional, semi-professional, whatever. I mean, they are going to be they audition, and we make sure that they can, you know, have proficient skills in reading and everything. But it's more of trying to have something that kind of comes from people just wanting to try something new musically, and who are curious about playing in ensembles that might not get a chance to. Maybe they used to, they don't anymore. Maybe it's some younger folks who are in high school and just. Really,
so all ages and yeah. different levels of yep. proficiency and experience?
Yeah, yeah.
And will membership in it, if that's the right word, change and evolve? Or will this be a set group that will continue to
play? I'm sure it'll change, yeah. I mean, like any ensemble, you have to be real flexible. And so, I mean, I even feel like if we end up with five baritone saxophones and three guitars, like that's a band. You know, I'll come up with the arrangements for it. I like that challenge. And I think it's important for musicians to think that way too. Like, just be flexible and use what you have in your community.
And is there a performance that will be the end goal, or is it really just about the experience of doing this every Monday night?
Yeah, there will be a end of semester, you call mm-hmm. it, I guess, mm-hmm. performance in the main hall. So it gives them a chance to be in the middle of this amazing room that we're talking about, and have a goal in the end as a. In addition to just like learning lots of new tunes and getting to play with people.
Randall Klein.
Yeah, I'd love to, you know, add a little bit to what I'm saying. What's beautiful about this particular band and where they're actually going to be rehearsing is part of this, because it ties in with this issue of openness and community. You know, this band was really designed for people who, you know, may have played in high school or college and played at a high level at those, and that it's something that they want to get back into, and with the student and the kind of professional, so people can really come together. But they're rehearsing in a room that is completely open to the street. It's one of the as you started the program here talking about openness, it's a completely glassed in room that feels like the sidewalk merges with this room. And anybody who goes by this room on the Monday nights that this band will play, or the Tuesday nights that our high school all-star band is rehearsing in those rooms, will actually see what happens in this building and have nothing in between them and the building.
So is part of the goal in this, in a way, John Santos, to have a place where creative expression is a lifelong pursuit? I mean, that it's available and to you as a kid, but again, that's something that you can come back to?
Certainly. That continuity is really taking root with this building. It's a dilemma that for bigger institutions, and I think right away of like the symphony, who if they don't do development and develop an audience with children and in schools with what they present, then they will lose their audience. And it's the same, of course, with jazz. And jazz being our national art form, it's really important that we do everything to get jazz into the community, into the schools, and as educating the community as best we can about jazz for that purpose, so that it will go on forever, stronger.
It reminds me a bit of, I happen to be working on a documentary film at the moment that's being filmed at the Mark Morris Dance Center in New York, famous modern dance company. It's about a particular aspect of their work. But what's striking about that place is that when you walk in, you don't actually know whether you're in the home of a renowned modern dance company or you're in a preschool. Because there are little kids who take dance classes there. There are people with Parkinson's disease who take dance classes there. There's sort of anything and everything. And it's very consciously a community center. It's the home of a great modern dance company, but it's a community center. Do you think of it that way, Mark Cavaniero, that this is a community place?
Yeah, absolutely. That was part of the vision from the beginning, part of the reason I think Randall really wanted to site the building in Hayes Valley, to be part of a real vibrant and emerging neighborhood, and at the same time have one foot in the major cultural center with the distinguished neighbors up Franklin. So I think the idea of being part of the community in the morning and the afternoon and then transforming at night to be this wonderful performing arts center whereas by day it's a community center and an education center, was the vision that Randall had.
And is that important, Adam Thies, to cultivating the state of jazz in San Francisco, that you want it to be open to the community, but you also need that if that's going to be a place that will sustain this into the future?
Right. I mean, it's the model that this center is based off of, as opposed to a club business, I think is what John was saying is going to help ensure it for the future. You have, it's not nonprofit. It's being funded by people who are jazz lovers and who maybe even just want to see live music survive, because that's been in danger too. So I think all these things come into play in making sure that this is, I mean, you kind of have to be holistic about it and bring people in as many different ways as you can. And if you have the support of the community, I mean, that's what's going to make it successful.
What, as we get ready for our break, and I'm going to ask John and Adam to play a little for us as we lead into our break, but how healthy is the state of jazz in San Francisco, Randall Klein?
Healthy. There are various barometers to measure, you know, health here, but the greatest sign is creativity in a community and people like Adam, you know, for one, you know, who is just resourceful and involved in so many different kinds of music. So San Francisco has always been a vibrant area for creativity, and it's got a really rich jazz history. And like everything has its ebbs and flows. But the dynamism here is really, you know, there. And so things are good. You know, people always ask me, what's new? Are there ideas? Is jazz on the wane? And my answer is always the same for all 30 years, actually, interestingly enough, is that there's never, there's always creative output. There's always people here. A little complicated in San Francisco and maybe another show, but it's also expensive to live in San Francisco, which actually drives a lot of the concentration of who gets to live here. When I moved here 30 years ago, I could rent an apartment, share an apartment for $100 a month, and I don't know what inflation adjusted what that is now. And there were parts of the city where it was very cheap to live in, but now it isn't, so there's a lot less artists here.
Let's listen to two of our artists, Adam Thies and John Santos, as we lead into our break. Adam Thies and John Santos. We'll pick up our conversation, hear more jazz in just a moment.
Como sei, vivo poema cantado de fado que eu inventei a falar. Não posso dar-me, mas ponho a alma a cantar e a zangar.
And that's a little bit of Maritza, who will be performing at the SF Jazz Center from March 14th to the 17th. A fado singer, Randall Klein, tell us about her.
Well, she's, you can hear the emotion in her voice, but fado music is really, the best way I can describe it is Portuguese soul music. And you can hear the African influences. She actually was born in Mozambique, and And it's some of the most passionate music you'll hear. And I was fortunate enough to hear her about 10 years ago. And actually, the theater that I heard her in originally helped inform the SF Jazz Center. It was one of those halls, actually at the Public Theater, the Anspacher Theater there, which we visited on our tours of venues. I was sitting in the worst seat in the house up in the corner, and I was just transfixed. It was just, you know, a mesmerizing performance. And so not just seeing her, who was mesmerizing, but how one could experience, mm-hmm. you know, something like that in a place where you would typically think you were in a bad seat.
I want to ask you all something about the music that gets heard in San Francisco. It's interesting that the building is a stone's throw away from Davies Symphony Hall and from the Opera House. And I'm curious, John Santos, as someone who has been in San Francisco forever and has cultivated your particular music, if this is an important statement in terms of making sure that this music gets heard.
You know, I think it's very important. Excuse me. It's super important, and it's logical that it happens in San Francisco. You know, growing up, being born and raised here, it's easy to take it for granted. We think that every place is like that. The block I grew up on had a white family, an Asian family, Filipino, black, a gay couple, had everything on one block, and you think that the world is that way. And as you grew up, you know, in my travels, I found that the world isn't like that. San Francisco, we grew up with so much great rock and roll, and Latin rock was born here, and jazz and blues and classical music. And in my particular case, my family ties of Puerto Rican music and Cuban music on my mom's side, my father's side from Cape Verde. So I heard a lot of that fado type music. I grew up with that music. So to have all of that represented and then some in the festival, it's logical. It's a natural thing. And it's very unique.
And is part of the sort of stance of the building, Mark Habanero, a counterpoint to Davies and the Opera House? Is it sort of a face-off? How would you describe the way in which the building sits itself in that push and pull between the cultural arts that are available in San Francisco?
Well, I would never say that it's a counterpoint, in as much as I think SF Jazz, the whole vision, I think, grew from the ground up and was about what SF Jazz wants to be and wanted to be and needed to be. And definitely needed to be something that was part of the community, and it definitely wanted to be something where the music inside would be elevated as an art form. So we wanted the Robert Minor Hall, the auditorium, to be a place that had the acoustic quality, the quality of materials, the quality of audience experience to be comparable to what one would find in a great place like SF Opera or Davies Hall, and at the same time find a way so it had a feel that was part of the neighborhood and the community.
I guess part of what I'm trying to get at I'll just read this. This is a quote from an article that Robert Mailer Anderson wrote about the new center in 7x7 magazine. And he said the following: "There's a whole canon of music, of which I'm a great fan and supporter, created and performed by the white middle class for the consumption of the white middle and upper class. And it brings up the question of whose stories get told, by whom and where." And I guess I'm just curious if the SF Jazz Center is in part making sure that those other stories get told. John?
Well, for sure. I think the SF Jazz Festival stands out among institutions and among festivals for doing precisely that and being conscientious about bringing artists in who are not just the most popular only, but a very eclectic group of musicians. And the artists are very in tune to those issues. Certainly in our work, we take a lot of pride in being able to express or represent a perspective, our own history, our own stories from our perspective. And that idea of writing history and documenting our experience in our own way and representing the communities which we come from is a big part of what informs our composing and our writing. So I think that's automatically inbred in what we're doing at SF Jazz.
What does that mean to you, Adam, as a young performer, to make sure that there is that sort of opportunity for stories to be told?
Well, I mean, it's always tricky because you want to keep the level high, you want to keep the quality high, you want to keep the reputation high, but there is that balance, and I feel like the really wide range of music that's presented is it would be probably a lot easier just to have more traditional jazz. There's other places that do that, and it seems to work okay. But I think pushing the boundaries, it's not just like a musician-y kind of thing, like, oh, we're going to have some new cutting-edge stuff or have crossover music, I think the cultural significance is something that it took me a while to grab onto, and because I'm coming more of it from a musician, college-trained musician thing, it really does make sense to be having these musicians coming from all over the world to our community because San Francisco is so diverse.
It is, and yet in some ways it's a less diverse place than it once was. Mm-hmm. To an extent, what you were referencing before, Randall, about the way in which this has become such an expensive place to live. The African-American population of San Francisco is half what it was 30 years ago. So is it important to make that kind of statement in this building?
Well, it's always been our intent to make that statement. And it wasn't actually in the sense of making a statement. It was always just who we were from the time we started. You know, John's block is where we live. I mean, metaphorically always. That's how I always felt. I moved to San Francisco in 75. I just immediately fell in love with this city. I don't know what it was about the city that captivated me. And as I got to know it more, I realized what it was this idea of people living together in a way that I had never experienced in a very sort of stiff New England set up, and immediately was what it felt. This was very different than what I grew up with, and I felt comfortable in it immediately. And you know, I guess I'm constantly trying to capture, as you know, trying to identify what it is about this community that makes it. And so all the programming and how we've done is been very naturally, you know, about John's block he grew up on.
John Santos,
Dave. excuse me. You bring up a very a great point about how the working class community is where the jazz community is. You know, that's where it comes from. That's a big difference. We might be right there next door to Symphony Hall and the ballet and the opera, but jazz has a different audience, and so that's a big part of the challenge. But it's one that SF Jazz has 30 years now of doing fantastic work in that area, and so by combining the education, by combining this very eclectic programming, and bringing in artists from all over the world, and understanding that jazz itself is an Afro-Caribbean art form, being born in New Orleans, it's totally connected to all the other major ports of the Caribbean for hundreds of years, and that realization about jazz, that fact, which gets overlooked real easily, and in most festivals in this country, that is something that's always been in the forefront of what SF Jazz has put forward.
We'd like you to join our conversation as well. If you have thoughts, questions about what the new SF Jazz Center represents, what will be going on in terms of programming, you can join us at 866-733-6786, 866-733-6786. Email us at forum@kqed.org, or you can post your thoughts or comments on our Facebook page or on our website. John posts on our Facebook page, "Jazz is what America is all about. Without African Americans, America really wouldn't have a culture. The beginning of the SF Jazz Center is great news." And Russ in Berkeley writes, "I'm a Giant Steps member of the new Jazz Center and encourage others to contribute. However, I do have a question. Clubs like Yoshi's, etc., continue to move away from what we think of as jazz to offer a lot more pop-style music. Is there really enough demand for great jazz in all its forms to keep the center going?" A reference to Yoshi's San Francisco, which has struggled financially and has gone more to sort of more pop music to get an audience. Is there an audience?
I have a different take, actually, on this idea of is there audience, because, you know, I've heard this actually from year one about, you know, is it like a fixed bucket of jazz fans out there and that's it. And in fact, this is one of the beautiful things about San Francisco and actually ties into why we chose the site we're at. We didn't choose our site, for instance, to be next to these cultural landmarks. We chose it because it was accessible. It was close to BART lines and Muni lines, and people could come into the building. And our approach towards audiences is about accessibility. This is exciting music, and we believe in its excitement and its vibrancy. And you know, and I don't mean to sound too Pollyannish about it, but you know, we just want to share it in the best way possible. And so, to answer the question about audiences, I think they're infinite audiences, actually. Maybe not infinite.
So why has Yoshi's struggled? I mean, what do musicians make of that, Adam, that Yoshi's San Francisco hasn't cultivated an audience for the kind of music that you all want to make sure gets heard?
There's a lot of reasons, and it's sad because I like to go out and listen to music a lot, and I mean, there's just so many things that I feel like they bit off more than they could chew in that space. It's a huge cavernous place. Having a respectable smaller venue within their large venue, I think, could have helped a lot. Their overhead's huge, way too high. And it just, I don't think it sounds very good in there. I mean, it broke my heart the first few shows I went there, went to there. But, you know, I hope they do well, because, I mean, I think having more places to go see jazz is really important.
And we should also note, Mark, that within your building there are, we've talked about the larger hall, but there are other smaller halls. And something I think I've read in every article about the new center is the word cup holder, that every chair has a cup holder, so that this will feel some more like being at a club, right?
Absolutely. And there's the Joe Henderson Lab, which will seat 60, 70, 80 people. That's the space that's right on the corner of Franklin and Linden. And along the way, I think the idea was that there could be performances in many spaces, impromptu in the green room, even in the lobby. The acoustic quality throughout the public spaces has been a focus for Randall and his co-director, Felice Swap, and we've really put a lot of work into that. And I think that'll emanate in a building that's full of life and transparency and emanate at all levels of, you know, ages of musicians.
John, you wanted to add something?
Yeah, well, just that for me also, one of the biggest challenges and problems that is faced is one about money, because, you know, art and music and jazz, it's an art form. It was never meant to be packaged and marketed and sold and all about the money. And that's why Yoshi's and other places are struggling. It's not because there's not an audience. Mm. It's because money, the question of money kind of, you know, is the root of all evil, to put it that way. But, you know, the money is the reason why there's suffering there. And it shouldn't be that way. It's about art. Art is not in the schools because of money. Art is not, is being drawn away from, you know, from clubs and from the audiences where the communities where it came from because of money. It's a shame, really. But that's a dilemma. And the fact that this building got built in a time, in these economic times, is a miracle. But now it's going to take another minor miracle in order for it to keep going. It's going to take a lot of the same creativity that went into the creation of this building, and it's going to be going on there on a nightly basis, has to happen in the community for the community to embrace it and for there to be enough of an economic flow to make it viable. It's a challenge.
Let's hear from some of our listeners on this topic. Dave joins us in San Francisco. Oh, sorry. We lost you, Dave. Call back, please, and we'll get you right back on. Let's go to Robert next in Oakland. Robert, go ahead.
Hello. My name is Robert Bradsby. Hello. Can you hear me?
Yeah, go ahead, Robert. You're on the air.
Okay. I'm one of the founders of the Sound Room, which is a new jazz venue in downtown Oakland. And I want to first off salute SF Jazz for their decades of really good work, and congratulations on the new place there in downtown San Francisco. I mean, it's a fabulous thing, a great place to showcase talent, local and national. But I would like to kind of speak about things that you all were saying a little earlier about the nonprofit model being perhaps a more viable format or business model for presenting live music, and especially improvisational music like jazz.
Robert, thanks. Cultivating that nonprofit model that John was speaking of and Robert just now, Randall.
Well, the model we undertook from the very inception was what was the best way to present jazz? What was the structure for it? And to John's point about money, I mean, really, it's how to support this. And my naive thought back in 1983 was if there were symphonic organizations and opera organizations in this country that could support these great art forms, could there not be a similar structure put together for jazz organizations? And that was a fairly new thought at that time, and shared by a small group of people to be able to do this. So that was the model we followed. In fact, the San Francisco Symphony itself was considered, for me, was the model. How do they do it? What are the ways that this can be done? Because this was designed about celebrating the art and educating people about the art. And that was not a model for jazz to that point, really. And so we put together a structure where people are contributors and part of our community in a different way, and a board of directors that's connected to the community as well, too. And the resources possible to say, this is important work. We ought to be experiencing it. We can change how people think about art and deeply move into the art.
Robert, thanks for the call and bringing up that point about how this can be supported going forward. Let's get to Dave again, who joins us next. Dave, go ahead, please.
Hi. I'm just curious. I know about the SF Jazz Collective, and I'm a local musician. I'm wondering how, beyond just the collective, how this new project is going to affect local musicians, and if it's going to provide us a new opportunity to play, or is it going to be mainly focused on out of state or even international groups? I mean, is this a new venture entirely, or what's the plan?
Great, Dave. Thank you. Adam, you want to speak first to that in terms of what you're looking for in terms of your band, and then John, maybe you can talk about opportunities for local musicians too.
Sure. The first 2 weeks is all featuring Bay Area artists who have been in the trenches and doing it and proving themselves for years and decades. So I was really excited to see that in the program, but you're probably speaking more long-term, of course, and I'm really excited about the smaller space, the Joe Henderson Lab, which is something that a lot of working musicians in the Bay Area would speak to, is that when you play a club the size of Yoshi's, not to pick on Yoshi's, when you play any large venue, the film or whatever, there's a pressure on you that is way beyond just making art. It's about selling tickets and business, and when you play smaller venues, you have this freedom to experiment and try new things. And so I think that room, especially for me, I'm excited about having the opportunity to play some smaller venues like that, Joe Henderson Lounge, but have it be a respectable place. And I think that's really key.
What do you mean by respectable?
Well, I mean, I love playing the small, like, quote, smoky clubs, even though they're not smoky anymore, fortunately. But I think there's something about having like a decent acoustical environment, and there's a lot of charming venues around, but there's always like one thing missing, kind of, and you just deal with it as a musician because you're happy to have a place to play. Yeah. And, you know,
John, add to that about opportunities for aspiring young musicians like Dave, who wants to think that this represents a possibility for him as well.
Yeah, that's part of the plan from the beginning, is to have it be accessible for local musicians. And there are smaller venues. The main room itself is adjustable. I think an important thing, though, is that it takes also creativity on the part of the local musicians and on the part of the local community, because jazz is suffering everywhere, not just in San Francisco. And music and the arts are suffering everywhere because of this economic crisis. And so it's not enough now to just say, well, my band, we play every week at this bar, and now we want to play at the SF Jazz Center, and we're going to show up over there and play. It's not that simple. You know, people are going to really have to be creative about what they present, about what they about themes, about guests, and do some more. You know, it just takes some creativity in order to make that happen.
And will this place also be a space that educates people like Dave about how to do what John is just describing? In other words, the way in which you have to grow as not only an artist, but in presenting your work and sort of making the case for your work being heard.
Absolutely. Education has become a greater focus as we've moved along and evolved. But the Joe Henderson Lab that we're talking about is the center of an educational wing for us, actually. There are three practice rooms in this wing for instrumental instruction and practice. One's big enough for a quartet to practice in. There's a digital classroom there where we can teach, you know, young adults and adults, tools to produce music and also to write music using, you know, latest technology. So education on a two levels, actually. It's training for young musicians in our high school jazz program is one thing, and it's appreciation is the other piece, and that bridges both young adults and adults. We've got a program called Discover Jazz. Rebecca Mullion, our education director, leads, and there's a number of series in our first season about teaching people about various aspects as adults about how music works, and it's extensive, and we're trying to make it very integrated with what we do on our stages.
And to Jeff next in San Francisco. Jeff, go ahead.
Hi. I just noticed the building for the first time the other day, although I've driven by it 1,000 times. It's beautiful. I've always wondered why SF Jazz never used Yoshi's as a venue. When, for instance, I've sat in folding chairs at Yerba Buena Center for the Arts in a gymnasium-type room there. It seems like Yoshi's was looking for the audience space, and you all were looking for venues. Was that ever tried?
Yes, in fact, we haven't presented in San Francisco Yoshi's. We presented in Oakland Yoshi's not quite a bit, but a few times over the years. We rarely, interestingly enough, presented in a club environment. So the reason we went to Yerba Buena, and I'm sorry of your viewpoint, Yerba Buena Forum, But we are, as Mark described too, more oriented on focus. And the cup holders are a big deal in the new theater. But the reason they're a big deal is they're, you can bring a drink in. There's no wait service. And really, you know, this is a very subtle difference between clubs and concert hall. But, there's a distraction to having wait service in a room. And it's something that it was just a personal thing for me. I also don't like going to outdoor festivals for that very same reason. When I want to hear music, I really want to hear music. And so while there's a great places, and I've seen some of the greatest jazz I've ever seen in nightclubs, we always differentiated ourselves by being more on the concert hall size. And now we have this opportunity to make that concert hall a little more intimate.
Jeff, thanks for the call. And will you continue to, I assume, use other venues? It's not like everything now about SF Jazz will happen at the new building.
Well, actually about 90-95% of what we do will be in the building now. We designed this building to be flexible so that we could do lots of things there. And, you know, there are the occasional artists, for instance, Tony Bennett's in our first season, and we'll present at Davies Symphony Hall across the street.
And to Dave next in San Francisco. Dave, go ahead.
Hi. I had a question for all three. The question is, what does the word jazz mean to you, to all three of you? And then I'd just be curious to know, like, what is it about jazz that you feel so passionately about and love? And part of it, I teach jazz history, and so I have to tell the kids what jazz is. And I feel like there's kind of a fight for the word and the meaning of the word.
And we'll include our architect as a jazz aficionado in that definition as well. But thanks, Dave, for the question. Let's have a go at that, Adam.
Wow, that's a tricky one. I mean, we all see this fight going on all the time. I think the fact that it's going on and there's a fight about it, like that's what makes me happy. If it was, oh, that's what it is. It's, you know, we play it just like it was played 200 years ago. Go down to the Jazz Center and see it. It'll be the same as it was last year. That's when I'll punch out and I'll probably be doing something else.
Mark?
I've always liked the improvisational quality of it as well as the structure. It's a very disciplined art form. And I think what I've learned over the years is that the jazz musicians are as studied and as knowledgeable and as incredibly sophisticated in their command of music as classical musicians. And I like the way that they take that command, but then go into other areas, but then it can come back and maintain that really serious structure to the quality of sound.
Well, Randall, your definition.
Well, to me, the not defining it, but the sense of what it is this idea of freedom within structure, of this very democratic ideal, and that In jazz, the one thing that you can't get in any other real music is this idea of this immediate creativity, that it's different every night, that something could happen that you'll never hear again. So the improvisational nature within the structure. And, you know, music, again, you can't get really tight on the definition because there's lots of jazz without any structure. And but the idea that for me, what attracts me to it without defining it is the sense that I could be transformed. I could go to hear something because someone on stage is doing something that is so connected with their being that moves everyone around them, including themselves, the excitement of it. And, you know, the issue of whether it has a swing element or doesn't, I mean, I think these are unimportant pieces of defining what jazz is.
John?
It's tricky, you know, to define art and define music. It's like looking at a painting and the painter trying to tell you what it is. You know, it's something different to everybody who looks at it. And with jazz, I like the idea of that it's not music at all. You know, Dixieland is a style of music, swing is a style of music, bebop is a style of music. Jazz is an attitude. Jazz is more like this, you know, freedom and truth, the truth, you know, not it's not about the profile, it's not about the promo, it's not about the look or the age, it's about the art form. And I love that SF Jazz is not trying to define what jazz is for the audience.
And is it important then that the center itself have a little attitude and that the building be a place where attitude can happen?
It's a slam dunk. I mean, you just walk, like that caller just said, I just drove by it and I took a double take and wow. And yes, for sure, it's got attitude, but it's not. But it fits in that neighborhood. We talked about that the other day. It's not like this big obelisk that sticks out. The guy drove by it 1,000 times before he noticed it, and then he noticed it, and it was like, wow.
By the way, we're not going to have time, unfortunately. Sorry, Joe, not to get to your question, but a couple of people have either emailed or wanted to phone in about why isn't this in the Fillmore? Just a brief response on that, Randall.
Yeah, to the The answer is in accessibility. In fact, when we looked through the entire city of San Francisco for a location for a number of years and tried to find places that this building could be most accessible to the most people, and it was really geographical more than any other influence to be in that neighborhood. We did want to be in a vibrant neighborhood. In fact, we're only four blocks from the Fillmore District, where we are now, very close to it, and we wanted to, you know, particularly around public transportation, BART, Muni were the big ones.
And last quick email question from Elena about acknowledging the African-American roots of jazz. We talked some about that earlier and about the proximity to the Fillmore. Is that something that you're going to be actively promoting in your role as one of the resident artistic directors too, John, to make sure that that is sustained within the new Jazz Center?
Well, I hadn't thought about it like that, but, you know, that's an interesting point. I think in all that we do as resident artistic directors, we bring in music. In my case, it's an Afro-Caribbean perspective, but it's very tied into the history of the music in the Fillmore. So my San Francisco roots just mean that's part of what I do. I hadn't had a conscious thought about connecting that neighborhood, but what I'm doing is connected to the history there.
And I'm going to ask you guys to pick up your instruments one more time as we go out of our show, if we might, and we'll listen to a little bit of Adam Thies and John Santos as they perform. And as they do so, I want to thank all of our guests, for participating in our program. Randall Klein, the founder and executive artistic director. Congratulations, by the way, Randall, on getting this all together. Thanks, too, to the architect, Mark Cavaniero, who has been with us, and to Adam Thies and John Santos. And let's listen to a little bit of John Santos and Adam Thies. This is Forum on KQED. I'm Dave Iverson.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation in honor of Louise and Claude Rosenberg.